You know, there's absolutely no rhyme or reason, no philosophy, no logic or anything else behind this sequence, because I didn't know what films were here when I came in on the boat Sunday, and we just lucked into this, but they fit very well indeed. This is, a comical film. It really is comical, and it's based on private kinds of experiences and insights, and yet it is an image. It is a symbol that I think is rather profoundly theological. But first, I want to develop the idea of how experience... Can you hear me? Is this... Okay, now this film, unlike most of the rest of the Kairos things that I've seen so far, are based on private experiences. In other words, they're universal kinds of statements, but they arise out of humor or out of pathos that have happened to people like our friend Stan that was here and the other man and the others that take part in that. I want to say something about that because the question that was left with me after yesterday's presentation, and if somebody can fix that damn box back there, good, because, you know, otherwise, I hate equipment, really. Is how do you communicate with other people? And I can't answer that, of course, but I can only speak from the standpoint of a creator in the sense of someone whose life and business is involved in trying to communicate with other people for a living as well as out of love, which is more profoundly true. You have to know who you're talking to. Then you have to know the difference between private experience and how that private experience can be converted into a universal kind of language. And you have to know the limitations of that. There are some things that are too deep for words. There are some things that are too deep for touch as well. There are some things which are purely individualistic. And yet, many times, it is these kinds of personal thoughts and experience that underlie the most majestic kinds of communication. I want to read to you a little bit from Hermann Hesse, the author of Siddhartha, in this particular book, The Glass Bead Game, Magister Ludi, the master of the game. You may know something about it. It's purportedly the life of Joseph Necht, who is the master of the glass bead game. At some future time, you might say, a cross between the head of the Atomic Energy Commission and the Roman Catholic Church, when there is a unity of knowledge that Hess believed very profoundly in. Since our data on Necht's early period in the elite schools are so sparse, we cite a passage from one of his later lectures on the glass bead game. Necht's own lectures for these beginners are not available. He delivered them extemporaneously. A pupil took them down in shorthand. At one point, Necht speaks about analogies and associations in the glass bead game, and in regard to the latter, distinguishes between legitimate, universally comprehensible associations and those that are private or subjective. Now, by way of parenthesis, the glass bead game is an analogy for the way the universe works. From every star in its course to every atom and every grain of dust to every thought and every neural function and every brain of every creature that ever lived, the glass bead game is the highest synthesis of logic and of chess and of all of the more universal kinds of grasping after what it is that are the kinds of structures and forms of the universe. And of course, the search for such structures and forms is what is meant by philosophy. He remarks, to give you an example, of private associations that do not forfeit their private value, since they have no place in the glass bead game. I shall tell you of one such association that goes back to my own school days. I was about 14 years old. It was a season when spring is already in the air, February, March. One afternoon, a schoolmate invited me to go out with him to cut a few elder switches. He wanted to use them as pipes for a water mill. We set out. It must have been an unusually beautiful day in the world, or in my own mind, for it has remained in my memory and vouchsafed to me a little experience. The ground was wet, free of snow. Strong green shoots were already breaking through on the edge of the stream. Buds and the first opening catkins were already lending a tinge of color to the bare bushes, and the air was full of scent, a scent imbued with life and contradictions. There were smells of damp soil, decaying leaves, and young growth. Any moment one expected to smell the first violets, though there were none yet. We came to the elder bushes. They had tiny buds, no leaves. As I cut off a twig, a powerful, bittersweet scent wafted towards me. It seemed to gather and multiply all the other smells of spring within itself. I was completely stunned by it. I smelled my knife, smelled my hand, smelled the elder twig. It was a sap that gave off so insistent and irresistible a fragrance. We didn't talk about it, but my friend also thoughtfully smelled it for a long time. That fragrance meant something to him also. Well now, every experience has its element of magic. In this case, the onset of spring, which had enthralled me as I walked over the wet, squishy meadows and smelled the soil and the buds, had now been concentrated into a sensual symbol by the fortissimo of that elder shrub's fragrance. Possibly I would never have forgotten this scent, even if the experience had remained isolated. Rather, every future encounter with that smell deep in my old age would in all probability have revived the memory of the first time I had consciously experienced that fragrance. But now, a second element entered in. At that time, I'd found an old volume of music in my piano teacher's. It was a volume of songs by Schubert, and it exerted a strong attraction on me. I had leafed through it one time when I had a rather long wait for my teacher. I asked to borrow it a few days. In my leisure hours, I gave myself up to the ecstasy of discovery. Up to that time, I'd not known Schubert at all. I was totally captivated by him. And now, on the day of that walk to the elderberry bush, or the day after, I discovered Schubert's spring song. And the first chords of the piano accompaniment assailed me like something already familiar. Those chords had exactly the same fragrance as the sap of the young elder. Just as bittersweet, just as strong and compressed, just as full of the forthcoming spring. From that time on, the association of earliest spring, the fragrance of elder, Schubert chords, has been fixed. It is absolutely valid for me. As soon as the first chord is struck, I immediately smell the tartness of the sap, and both together mean one thing to me. Spring is on the way. This private association of mine is a precious possession. I would not willingly give it up. But the fact that two sensual experiences leap up every time I think spring is coming, that fact is my own personal affair. It can be communicated, certainly. I have just communicated it to you. But it cannot be transmitted so to affect a single one of you that my private association will become a valid symbol for you in your turn. It can never be a mechanism which infallibly reacts on call and always follows the same course. We can communicate, but we cannot transmit. In preaching, I think we forget this sometimes, and I'm always glad when I have humble homiletics professors around me. that know that there are no infallible rules for preaching. And in fact, if there is one, it ought to be broken regularly. I'm very serious about that. We can communicate, but we cannot transmit by art or by science. If we were computers, I could simply press whatever button within me releases a stream of electrons on a tape or a wire, and it could communicate those things to you. And the same shape and the same form of those electrons could fall upon you and be reproduced by your reproducing devices and sound so much, at least to the untrained ear, like a faithful reproduction of what I had said. But as far as we know now, and even this is in doubt, the computer could not feel. We could not transmit a private experience, an experience, if you will, of grace from one to the other if we were only communicating animals. And this is a dilemma that we find ourselves in as artists, as creators, as preachers, as a Christian, or as any sensitive human being who would touch the lives of others, mold and direct, not in the sense of shaping in some overarching way, but of helping, of caring, and of concern. And now this little movie, which I saw for the first time with you here, this great person, the Red Baron type, he reminds me of a psychology professor friend of ours, Charlie Swisher. He's a couple 3,000 miles away, so I call his name. Just that crazy, just that kind of mustache and goggles and acting like that. He is the image of the Christian church to me. And again, I repeat, I know not what private experiences the makers of this film had. I know not particularly what private insights they experienced to produce this, but what it is transmitting to me is, boy, here is a Christian church. Here is the U.S. government and the Canadian government. Here is the UN. Here is every charitable organization and do-gooder God ever put on earth rolled up in a barrel. You know, you've got to be helped our way or damn you, you know. It was much too easy to dig the poor out of the hole, you know, with these gloves or the shovel. It had to be done just right. But it's so true, particularly of churches. This is true of foreign missions as well as of a lot of home missions, too. You know, when the hole is empty, voila, he is risen. We'll stick a dummy back in the hole and keep it going. Yeah, it has to be done. It's really beautiful, you know. You have to be helped our way. And what makes it so excruciating is that it's done out of charity in the very Latin sense of caritas, of love. You know, if they really didn't care, they really were playing with you, you know, the way a boy plays with a little fly in a matchbox. This would be cruelty. We can understand this. This is human. It might even be redemptive. But it's done out of love. I thought that cutting the holes in the electric blanket was pretty good myself. I know not what private experience he had, but the Red Baron there with the binoculars and his own personal testimonial reminds me of most of the bishops, a lot of the preachers, and the lay people, and the missionaries, and the professors, and the pastors, and the secular Y workers, most of them I have known. Think about it. But remember that you can get a communication out of that, but if you get a transmission, and I suppose this is a theological thing, it is a pure act of grace. Nobody can take counsel with a camera or a pen or a paintbrush and manipulate the matter of the world in such a way that it infallibly will transmit that same feeling and insight.
Never. Consequently, in religion, this means that preaching and catechizing is always intellectual. I'm sorry to say that, and I could be quite wrong, but it will always be on that level. It can never be anything else, although we ought to play it down as much as possible. When the midwife, exactly.
This is right.
And the transmissions, I suppose, happen when two pregnant people meet each other. We'll have to,
Something.
Well, this by way of coming down, again, without any particular kind of rhythm or rhyme to this, and we do with what we have, and that's the best way, because transmissions can happen then. We don't have so much to communicate. I communicate one thing. I noticed that McLuhan, Hot and Cold, is in the library, and it would be worth your looking at, kind of a nice little collection of essays. I didn't notice this because I was just between breaks there last night, but Understanding Media, the Extensions of Man, probably is there, and you might want to look at that too. And by the way, since time is limited and I function best after dark anyhow, much of this we should carry on, you know, in the sauna or drinking coffee or something. Okay. Now, I know not where to go yet, but I will do some music, Chris. I just want now to read a poem by an utterly insane poet and see what happens out of it. But first, I want to read a little bit by another utterly insane poet, Oscar Wilde. It's called De Profundis, Out of the Depths. And they're quite different. I only read this for one purpose, and that is to say that sometimes we are too critical of those who make film, those who make music, those who make poems and novels and books, because it all seems so simple. I suppose we can be critical of God when a baby comes through hydrocephalic or mongoloid. We can be critical of nature and of God without taking into account what it really means to put together a well-formed child. Now, this is a totally different situation. Oscar Wilde is in prison for 2 years for homosexuality, and he is writing now to the young man who was the cause of his being thrown into prison. This is a biography from prison, Out of the Depths. But what he is telling this young man is what you never realize is the agony of creation. And he says, not for these silly laws of the British Empire am I chiding you, but I am chiding you because you do not understand what it means to be in the grip of the Creator Spirit. I have to skip a good deal of it to try to get to it. I have no doubt that in this letter, in which I have to write of your life and mine, of past and future, of sweet things changed to bitterness and bitter things turned to joy, there will be much that will wound your vanity to the quick. If it proves so, read the letter over again until it kills your vanity. In it you find something of what you feel that you are unjustly accused of. Remember that one should always be thankful that there is one thing of which he can be unjustly accused. I think that's very good theology myself. If there be in it a passage that brings tears to your eyes, weep as we weep in prison, where the day nor less than the night is set apart for tears. It is the only thing that can save you. If you go complaining to your mother so that she can flatter and soothe you back into self-complacency, you will be lost. And if you find one false excuse for yourself, then you will find 100, and you will be no better than you were before. Do you say that I attribute unworthy motivation to you? You have no motives in life. You have appetites only. A motive is an intellectual aim. You were very young when our friendship began, Your defect was not that you knew so little about life, but that you knew so much. The gutter and the things that live in it had already, when I met you, begun to fascinate you. That was the origin of the trouble in which you sought my aid, and I so unwisely, according to the wisdom of this world, out of pity and kindness, gave it to you. You must read this letter right through. The letter is 100 pages long. You must read it, though every word may be to you as the fire and the knife of the surgeon that makes your flesh bleed. Remember that the fool in the eyes of the gods and the fool in the eyes of man are very different. One who is entirely ignorant of the modes of art and its revolutions, or the modes of thought and progress, of the pump of the Latin line, of the richer music of the vowel Greek, of Tuscan sculpture or Elizabethan song, may yet be full of the sweetest wisdom. The real fool that the gods mock is he who does not know himself. I was such a one too long. You have been such a one too long. Be no more this way. Be not afraid. The supreme vice is shallowness. Everything that is realized is right. Remember that whatever is misery to you to read is greater misery for me to set down. I will begin by telling you I blame myself. As I sit in this cell in convict clothes, disgraced and ruined, I blame myself. In the nights, I blame myself. I blame myself for allowing an unintellectual friendship, a friendship whose primary aim was not the creation and contemplation of beautiful things. And you will remember, of course, Plato. You will remember his dialogue on love. From the very first, there was too wide a gap between us. You had been idle at your school, worse than idle at university. You did not realize that an artist, and especially an artist as I am, that is a poet, that is to say, the quality of whose work depends upon the intensification of personality, requires for the development of his art the companionship of ideas, an intellectual atmosphere, quiet, peace, solitude. You admired my work when it was finished. You enjoyed the brilliant success of my first nights and the brilliant banquets that followed them. You were proud, and quite naturally so, of being the intimate friend of an artist so distinguished. But you could not understand the conditions requisite for the production of artistic work. I'm not speaking in phrases of rhetorical exaggeration, but in terms of absolute truth to actual fact, when I remind you that during the whole time we were together, I never wrote one single line. The mark of the sin into which Wilde fell was that it deserted him of his creativity. And all the time he was the companion of this young man, he never wrote a line. And when he reproaches himself, it is for being so grossly ignorant of knowing that the mark of evil is a lack of creativity. But love frees for creativity, regardless of what is done.
I suppose to hearken back to the little film, the creativity that was released there was rather immense. I mean, it's kind of unusual how we go around our elbow to get our thumb sometimes. And I don't suppose there are bigger creators in the world than people who organize churches. I don't mean small churches, but, you know, like Franklin Clark Fry's. There's got to be, you know, a special place in hell, if there's a hell, for people that organize things like that. Rube Goldberg probably is in charge, I guess. And so now, from a mad poet, I call this syllables of matter, molecules of mind. And I'm thinking of the creative process as the mark of grace and as the evidence of the Holy Spirit's presence in our life. And I dedicate this to a teacher of mine over 20 years ago. Syllables of matter, molecules of mind. And he uttered forth those syllables that became matter, voicing in their phonemes molecules that would become mind. In time, they did. The skeleton built up of bony phrases became sentences. The organs in our bellies, paragraphs. We are the echoes of those sounds, yet not precise. The niceness of his enunciation has been slurred, blurred, and bounced, distorted sentences. Omega point missed since alpha's lost. We are graffiti on the bricks of fallen Babel, not clear writing on a Median palace wall. History is a soundtrack whose electrons are rubbed bare by a trillion passes over the scored head of the imperfect cosmological machine. The children sing, foo-foo little rabbit, running through the forest, digging up the field mice, bang 'em on the head. 10 years later, they enter the Asian village and make everybody dead. Echoes we, ill-formed sounds we curse, not bless. The atoms of our faces fused with fear, signatured with suffering, sterling marked with pain, amplified in war, replayed in stereo. The groans of the battered warriors at Agincourt, the whimpers of the children at My Lai Four. Deafened by the static of our sense, we misunderstand the word that is our life, like Heraclitus overcome by noise. We term swords and spears princes' toys, and seeking out the where and whence, name the father of all strife. Now between the private insight and experience and the public act of communication, no matter how tender or sensitive, there is a great gulf fixed. And like the gulf between Gehenna and Abram's bosom, it can be passed only by the Holy Spirit. And yet we must try. And I think this is the reason we must give the Creator every break possible. That does not mean that we need to put up with amateurishness in those who ought to be professional.
It does not mean that we ought to put up with a demonic message that ought to be healthy and whole, but we ought to give the Creator who is trying every break, entering into what is being done or has been done completely. If on the technical level there is a mark of difference between that which is purely Eddie Guest type poetry or simply paint by the numbers art and what is really artistically done, it is that the real demand that you think and that you feel and that you stand back and look long and involve yourself in it. Whatever is too close to the surface or on it has sacrificed, you see, that coolness, that involvement, that wrestling with others, that is the great joy of artistic creativity. I do not think that we do not communicate because we are unclear. I think we do not communicate because we do not care enough to involve ourselves deeply enough to be re-involved from the other direction. But again, I warn, we communicate, we cannot transmit. You can never know what passed in the synapses of my brain, and this is not a good poem, to see in the children's little play song the connection to the killing of the babies in my life hole. But if you can see the connection between playing with guns as children and being warlike as adults, you're on the way. But we communicate when we cannot transmit.
You know, the word that both Jesus and Paul use for this, it doesn't come out of English. Jesus says, I'll do just that. Keep on with this agon, this strive at the end of the human heaven for many striving, even though I'll do just that. And Paul says, having the same agon in you, which is Jesus being in me. Our word agony comes from that, but it's the full arena of conflict to understand and to act in the sense that each other that these are speaking of works with God and man. And you said you use pride because you said really about that and I'm very close to him. I criticize a particular communication here because you've forgotten this is the element that really makes it click. And I had a three-page hand letter with back from him, a beautiful letter, because he told you to see the other guy that I didn't love. But back in the letter he said if I'd been in the LCA with Peter, but my misfortune was to fall from my weakness. But this element of the human, the action we take in ourselves and another, the speech to anger of communication. I like to think about the fact that you get mentioned that I said that I've been in contact, then there's communication, and then there's communion.
I think transmit and communion would come very close together in the way that it's being used here in that sense. And that, of course, is something that can't be manipulated.
Holy Spirit alone can do that. And that's why I'm moving, because our own confessions begin with who we get to wander, we get to mess, they all, where am I to be with God? All those faith in whom we will. There can be no pressure, no manipulation, no intrusion. The mystery remains.
Very good. This poem is not as complex as the last, and it grew out of going to my home state to investigate something on the islands of the sea there for an article. And it's less a poem, I suppose, because it ends up didactically. It has a sermon in the last line. Maybe up to that line it's a poem. It's called John's Island, South Carolina. Mud gray and porous,
beaten with smooth worn edges the walls of the tenant cabins, soaked with the tears of untreated sickness, dried in the sweat of exploitation, made cold by the darkness of forgottenness. Huddled in groups under dying oaks, peopled with spirits and off-breed chickens, invaded by invalided motor cars now rusting, companioned by old cars, cans, and tires, black, deep black, shiny black, gleaming with humanity, though marked by other men's inhumaneness, the faces greet us. Quiet, musky, still, far from the highway, yet not to the sea, lost between the rivers of concrete and the rivers of salt, there in the tall grasses, under the Spanish moss, finite suffering and infinite patience. Swear by the love of Christ that you will work and fight for the poor and ignored. Art, when it is didactic, ceases to be art in its fullest sense. And yet there is a didactic or teaching element in all art. One does not attempt to communicate or transmit or hold communion unless there is something there that is passing. But it should never come out that blatantly. Sometimes we run into it. And by the way, some of the best spiritual poetry that you can read is written by people in their communist period out of the 20s and the 30s. Never since, even after their conversion in many cases, have they written as good poetry that it is as open to this feeling, you know, of servanthood. I'm very serious, and I'll read you one day some of the poetry by people who long now have given up that Marxism, and perhaps also lost in their youth, too, some of that grace. It's an unusual world. You cannot measure it and cut it so easily. Do you know Archibald MacLeish? Discovery of this time. Not by the poet. Nobody borrowed a couple of dogs and a gun and packed out, keeping the evening forward, keeping the thrush to the left hand of the sun, following wandering water, building cover in 4 foot of wet snow and underbrush, bringing the evidence back in a bag, a plover, a large bird killed on the nest with no name for it. No one set out for it. Nobody looked for the way that we came here. Not by the philosophers. Nobody sat out a map of the whole world, measured the drift of the stars, of the letters and bottles, figured the flight of the lapwing, marked the compass courses on the chart. Here there will be islands. Here there will be shores. Coasts here will show where the dolphins are. Nobody figured it out on a fine morning, propped on a wine butt by a windy sea with a lit pipe and a lead stub and a board's end, and their sails, and there was logwood on the sea. Not by the conquerors either. Nobody led us here. Nobody lined us up in the town's field, shipped us up in barges, fought at the stormy head, marched on for 3 days through the desert, encountered the elephants, beat them, buried the dead in a closed ring, and the next night to the west of us, seagulls o'er the sand, the wings numberless. There are leaders enough, and they say what a mouse says, but none of them led us here. No man beat the drum. trek to the site of it, mark the shore and the harbor. We came by ourselves. We looked and we had come. There was one day and we walked from our lives and we stood here. There was one day and we moved out. The neighborhood sold the farms, leaving the stock in the paddock, leaving the key in the lock and the cake on the table, letting the door slam, the tap drip. There was one day, and we looked, and we had come here. No one discovered it. No one intended it either. There we were, all of us, all together, and we came. And you may take it as you will. It can be the story of America. MacLeish is not only our official poet, but a great lover of our history, of its wickedness as well as its goodness. And more than that, on the deeper level, it is a discovery of death. One day, we slam the door and let the tap run. And all of us together, we came. And the second coming, just one day, without planning, and no communication by communion or transmission, not by the leaders or the conquerors, the poets or the theologians or the philosophers. It comes, and we find that we came. Tomorrow, I'm not sure exactly what we'll do. We'll probably not have a film in the morning. We'll probably do poetry and some novels, talk about some plays. We will have a film tonight, right? Tuesday night, we're going to show The Supper, after which we'll have our Vespers with Holy Communion. And you'll see, I think, some of the appropriateness of that, so that this will be tied together. But to leave a little word from Edgar Lee Masters, maybe you remember Masters, Seth Compton. When I died, the circulating library, which I built up for Spoon River and managed for the good of inquiring minds, was sold at auction in the public square. As if to destroy the last vestige of my memory and influence. For those of you who couldn't see the virtue of knowing Volney's ruins, as well as Butler's analogy, and Faust, as well as Evangeline, were really the power in our village. And often you ask me, what's the use of knowing the evil in the world? I'm out of your way now, Spoon River. Choose your own good and call it good. For I could never make you see that no one knows what is good who knows not what is evil, and no one knows what is true who knows not what is false. And maybe we'll take it up there tomorrow. Have a good day. Okay, we have enough time? It's fine. Yeah, whatever, yeah. Tomorrow, by the way, since there won't be a film, we can meet over in Koinonia. I'd like that very much, yeah. Excuse me. I'll guess with you. But of course, it is a mystery, and it's a mystery to the atheist who creates as well as to the Christian. It remains that. But we should talk about that. We do know some kinds of things that promote creativity.
One thing, maybe I'm transgressing the time, but paying too much damned attention to time kills creativity. And, you know, too much attention to syllabi, for example, it used to kill me when I was the chairman in the university department having to demand syllabus of what you're going to do in class or textbooks. We know these things kill creativity. I know this kills the professional teacher, but it's true, it kills thinking too. I know the Kaiser outfit. Which one? Yeah. Oh, yeah, Vitamin Caves. Yeah, this is one that we show, by the way, to our humanities students at Finley College. The New Yorker and Punch, of course, come out with good cartoons sometimes. I think some years ago they had one about, you know, the two cavemen and sitting down and yes, and today after tomorrow we get around to inventing the wheel, you know, this sort of thing. And there are people that I have met and known, you know, like next year I'm going to fall in love, you know, so. Yeah. You don't plan the night I write a poem, believe me, yeah. Just turning loose the creativity in every living being, yes, exactly. Yes, this is very beautiful. You have to have the courage of imperfection. In other words, if you paint in your bedroom and you don't want anybody to see it because you're not a good painter, well, you are really not a good painter. And it's not because you're not a good painter, technically. And same way with poetry, if you write it for the closet. This isn't completely always true. Emily Dickinson is a great no to that. You know, she wrote on old envelopes and toilet paper and stuffed them in the drawer and this sorts of things. I think during a lifetime, one or two things. But she had a problem a little greater than most. But you have to have the courage of your convictions and put it forward. And then one thing that I've learned, and this is a bad word, which Paul Tillich always used to call me when I have to explain every day for 2 years what I meant by plastic art, which is my stupid way of saying, you know, with your hands, with plastic and clay and stone and metal, the kind of thing we see around here. But what I learned from those people, and in the university I managed the minor part of the master's program for a number of sculptors who remain my friends to this day, was that they had the courage of their convictions. They would make this thing. It would be very expensive to buy the materials and hundreds of hours to go into it, and they put it up. And I'd say, I'm amazed, you know, I don't really understand it, but I respect it. And then he'd tear it all to pieces, break it. It didn't do what I said. That's very hard, because the hardest thing I think in life to do, short of suffering death, is to rub out a word or a line that you've written. And that really is hard. And to break and shatter something like that, you know, this is the mark of a real artist. And you see it all the time. You can't be around an art department with a lot of sculptor-type people without seeing all the broken stuff. And it isn't accidentally broken. Then you know you haven't got a hack who's going to open up a candle in pottery shop and sell you for $5 something that they cost 29 cents to make. This is art. So creativity, I don't know, but it does come out of a conflict. I don't suppose I can think of a single creative person in history who hasn't in some way been in trouble with the people of his time. And wouldn't, I suppose, by whatever standards the state of Washington used for normality, have a problem with mental health. Serious.
That's where art and land is.
Very good, thank you. And I guess it's time for the next function, yeah?
Coffee break.
Coffee break, okay. Yeah. Oh, you're going to show it tomorrow?